finding the light in every situation.
Francesca, what I tried to do in this book was share as honestly as I could the stories of how I built the person I am today. And I used the metaphor Koma Rebbe, dappled light in the treetops, because I really wanted to show readers that my life, like their lives, are filled with light and shadow, and that there's a way to find the light with effort, with choice, in every situation.
That's Mary Pfeiffer. Later in the show, we talk with her about her new memoir, A Life in Light, Meditations on Impermanence. But first, a stunning debut novel from poet and translator Anita Barrows.
I feel like the novel is a novel about isolation and coming into connection.
We talk with her about The Language of Birds. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Anita Barrows is a poet, translator, and therapist working with children with disabilities, including autism. She draws on all these vocations in her debut novel, The Language of Birds. The novel is beautifully written. There's the poet. It's about two sisters, one autistic, the other socially isolated, and their struggle to connect with others and their own strengths. There's the therapist. And in exploring the world of an autistic character, Barrows translates that world for the reader with sensitivity and compassion. Both sisters carry the burden of loss, as we will see in our conversation with the author. But coming to terms with that loss unlocks the resilience within each of them to open to the love and care of others and return it. I was profoundly moved by The Language of Birds. Anita Barrows has published 3 poetry volumes and has received awards for her poetry from the National Endowment for the Arts and other foundations. Her translations with Joanna Macy of Rilke's poetry and prose have been set to music and nominated for national awards. Barrows teaches at the Wright Institute in Berkeley, California, and maintains an active therapy practice specializing in trauma and developmental disabilities in children, adolescents, and adults. Anita Barrows, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much, Francesca. I'm delighted to be here.
I love this novel, The Language of Birds. Beautifully written, affected me emotionally, I have to say. I actually cried at different times in the book because it moved me so profoundly. It's partly a coming-of-age story of the protagonist, Gracie. Tell us about Gracie and her family.
So Gracie is the elder of 2 sisters. Her younger sister is Janie, and Janie has autism, and that becomes a central issue in the book. Gracie originally lives with her mother and father, but when Gracie is about 12 and Janie is 4 and a half, the mother has essentially, a bipolar breakdown, a manic episode, and kidnaps the children and takes them on a trip that makes no sense, where they're going from one place to another. Every other day, they're somewhere else in Europe. She's leaving her husband, the kid's father, and they wind up at the grandmother's house, Gracie's mother's mother, in Germany. And there, the mother, leaving the children with the grandmother, commits suicide. And the father comes back and brings the girls home to Berkeley, which is where I live. So the landscape of the novel is a landscape that I'm deeply familiar with.
And you are a poet and a psychotherapist, and I would say the language in the book is certainly the language written by someone who is a poet. And also the work that you do as a psychotherapist. So these both have some bearing, it seems, on this novel, your first novel. How did your other work inform the story?
It very much did. In fact, the novel, which I began writing about 20 years ago, grew from a case that I saw when I was just an early career psychologist. I've been doing psychotherapy with children for about 40 years now. And early in my career, I worked with a child who was extremely bright and definitely on the autism spectrum. And I often say I learned how to do psychotherapy from working with that child. I ended up working with her from the time she was 5 till the time she was 17. And from my work with her, I began to specialize in working with children on the autism spectrum, although I also work with children who are traumatized and with children who have other kinds of issues. But I was encouraged by colleagues and supervisors, because that particular child was so interesting. I was encouraged to write about her. And what they were encouraging me to write was a nonfiction book, sort of documenting my work with her. And although I know that kind of thing has been done and done beautifully, I didn't feel that I could ethically write about that child. But the idea stayed with me. And when I began writing a passage that was about 60 pages long that actually never made its way into the published novel, it was that child on whom I based the character of Janny.
Well, that's so interesting, because Janny goes from a pre-verbal child who tantrums a lot to a girl who is an expert on birds, and then later as a young woman who has a job as a vet tech, veterinarian's technician, and who is, you know, one can only say extremely successful in her life. Is this a trajectory that the girl that you worked with went through?
It's a similar trajectory, although her career is not as a vet tech, but she has another profession for which she got a master's degree. She's now in her early 40s, which is just amazing to me, and I still hear from her occasionally. And actually, many of the autistic children I've seen, given the existence now of treatments and a kind of understanding that didn't exist when I first started working with autistic children. I think the diagnosis itself has broadened and the number of autistic children has grown exponentially for various reasons. But the positive side of that is that people know more about what to do with autistic children, so that somebody with autism can actually have a life that's fulfilling.
So talk about the family dynamics in the story. After the father brings the kids back, he gets very involved with Janny. Gracie is a bit of an afterthought, and then there is a stepmother, Kate, who's also a very interesting character and a very compelling character. So talk about the family dynamics.
Yes, the father, who, while the mother, Emmy, was still living at home and Janny was a tiny child, had tried to persuade the mother that there really was something not right with Janny. And the mother refused to believe it. And the mother was very merged, even fused with Janny. So once the mother is dead and the father is in charge of the girls, out of, you know, perhaps a sense of guilt, perhaps a sense of missed responsibility, he makes it his project to get Janny all of the treatment possible. So he has a speech therapist and, you know, gets a proper diagnosis. And eventually Janny goes to a special school, which is modeled on an actual school that some of the autistic children I've worked with attend. And Gracie, as you say, becomes a kind of afterthought because she's the, air quotes, easy child. And Kate, both the father and the woman he eventually becomes involved with and then marries, Kate, are high school teachers. The father is somebody who is a deeply good person. He's very kind and well-meaning, but he has very little capacity for emotional expression. Kate, on the other hand, is very emotionally intelligent and tuned in. And Kate is the one who, as she comes to know the two girls, perceives that everything is not okay with Gracie. And I've certainly seen this in a lot of the families I've worked with in my practice, where the child who is developmentally disabled or ill gets all of the attention, and the other child or children in the family tend to kind of go unnoticed because they're not perceived as needing as much. But Kate sees this kid, Gracie, who in high school doesn't seem to have any friends, spends all her time at home reading, is very closed up, and Kate really gets worried about her.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Anita Barrows about her novel, The Language of Birds. Gracie is not all that welcoming of Kate.
Right. That's a wonderful understatement. Gracie really dislikes Kate. And again, you know, I've certainly seen this in my practice. I've seen it in people very close to me. My granddaughter was very unaccepting of her stepfather when my daughter got involved with him. He is the most wonderful stepfather on the planet. And now he and my granddaughter, who's 21, are very close. But it's frequently the case that even a kid who is being well taken care of by the step parent resents that person's intrusion on the family. And Kate is so different from Gracie and Janney's mother. You know, Kate is not bipolar. She's not a dark, brooding, troubled person. Eventually, Kate's story becomes clearer. Kate reveals a lot to Gracie that, you know, Gracie wouldn't have guessed about her, that she didn't exactly have an easy time of it growing up. But Gracie just sees all of the ways in which Kate is different from Emmy. And also, Kate is trying to draw Gracie out. And Gracie has come to establish or participate in a kind of modus vivendi with her father, where they just don't talk about anything. So when Kate tries to draw her out, Gracie resents that terribly.
Yes, and Gracie also doesn't talk really with other people, with a few exceptions. She says at one point in the novel, The Language of Birds, she says that she lives in a world of lies. She doesn't tell anyone about her mother's suicide. She says the difference between the world of truth, you live with other people. In the lie world, you are alone.
Yes, and that phrase, even though I wrote it, it still gives me the chills when I hear it. Because on some deep level, I feel like the novel is a novel about isolation and coming into connection. And that lying that Gracie does is absolutely isolating to her. It's as though she weaves a cocoon of lies around herself and then she doesn't know how to get out of it. And originally it's protective. She doesn't want to think very much about her mother's suicide. She couldn't save her mother. That comes out at one point in the novel in conversation with a girl, Gina, that she does become friends with. You know, she had felt like she needed to save her mother and she couldn't. It also comes out in a conversation with Kate. So she would rather just push that away. And also, Janney is a kind of embarrassment to Gracie. And Gracie doesn't know how to talk about Janney, and Gracie doesn't really as a young teenager. She doesn't really accept Jannie's autism. She just thinks it's weird and bothersome. So she lies about that as well. But then she begins to realize that all her lying makes it impossible to make friendships and to talk about anything real with anybody.
And now tell us more about Jannie, and particularly her connection with birds. I mean, you just said that this is a book about breaking out from aloneness to connection, and that's as true for Jannie as it is for Gracie.
Yes, exactly. As you mentioned, Jannie, at the beginning of the novel, the beginning of her life, has no language. It's true of a lot of children with autism. It used to be that if a child didn't speak by the age of 5, the prognosis for that autistic child was very poor. It's no longer the case given all of the therapies that exist, but many autistic children don't speak in the early years. So Jannie didn't speak until, ironically, their mother died. She said her first word on the day of the mother's funeral. Jannie, like a lot of children with autism, has a passion for something other than human friendships. Jannie develops this passion for connection with birds in the process of her early treatment. She's learning to speak, and she becomes interested in birds. One of Gracie's hypotheses is that Jannie is interested in birds because they're kind of like she was at her most autistic, flapping their wings and screeching. And Jannie, like a lot of autistic kids, flapped her hands and screeched, flying away. Jannie was a great escape artist early on. And so there's some sense of an affinity she feels with birds. But she, again, like a lot of people with autism, develops this sort of hyper focus on birds and learns everything she can about them and learns how to draw them and draws them beautifully. And she learns about wild birds as well as the birds that she's raising herself. And through her connection with birds, she learns about the world because, you know, birds are in the world. They're in the environment. They're affected by the environment. And also she develops a connection with a bird store. I have to say the bird store in the book is a real bird store in Berkeley. I happen to have a number of birds myself. I have finches and parakeets and a canary. And they're fascinating to watch, and they do have their own language. And Jannie, early in the development of her own language, really learns the language of birds. She learns to understand them, and they become her way of entering the world. And the fact that toward the end of the book, she's working at this, when she's an adult, I should say, she's working as a bird rescuer, and then toward the end of the book, she gets accepted into this veterinary technician program. So she really is going to have a career working with birds. You know, when I came up with that, it made me cry. Because so connected to these two girls, I thought, oh my God, yes, Jannie is going to have a real life.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Anita Barrows about her novel, The Language of Birds. Now, there's another story in this book. Jannie does develop a friendship. I mean, she actually has a couple of friendships, but one that is particularly important to her is with a fellow classmate named Gina, who is in a very abusive and traumatic situation, is quite a remarkable character. Talk about Gina and did I say Jannie? I meant...
You said Jannie, yeah. I knew you meant Gracie.
Talk about the relationship between Gracie and Gina, and what were you exploring in this thread of the story?
Yeah, Gina fascinates me so much that I've begun writing a second novel in which Gina is the protagonist as an adult. Both Gracie and Gina are outcasts on some level. They're not. They find each other through a discussion in their high school English class about some poets who committed suicide, and Gracie, who generally just doesn't say anything and sits in the back of the class and gets straight A's on all her papers but doesn't reveal anything about herself. Gracie gets very upset during the course of that discussion about the way many of the other students are reacting. And when she happens to meet Gina just by coincidence a few days later, Gina really sees who she is, doesn't reveal that right away. But Gina says, hey, I got that this subject meant something to you. And Gina intuits that Gracie might actually write. She's seen some of Gracie's papers that the English teacher has read aloud in the class. And Gina admits to Gracie that she too writes poetry. Gina, in so many ways, is the polar opposite of Gracie, because Gina is as direct as Gracie is elusive. Gina is, she's courageous in a way that Gracie admires and is a little bit intimidated by and also fascinated by. And I think because they share this mutual sort of outcast identity, they begin to connect with each other. Gracie learns that Gina's mother has also died, and Gina is very out front with the fact that her mother died, whereas, you know, Gracie has never talked to anybody about it, and it becomes, you know, Janny who runs into Gina walking one day with Gracie, and Janny says, oh yeah, our mom died. And that's how Gina learns it. But Gina's mom has died of an overdose, and Gina's dad is also an addict and, you know, victim of the Iraq War, like a lot of people, you know, came back psychologically broken and turned to drugs. Gina is somebody who has really suffered from the things that are so structurally wrong with our society, from poverty, from, you know, her father's reaction to being in the war and all of that, from her parents' addictions. And Gracie really, really comes to love Gina. I mean, in fact, there's almost a little erotic connection between them. And Gina comes to love Gracie. But it's very hard for Gracie to integrate Gina into her life. At first, Gina comes to the house only when the parents aren't home, because Gracie kind of, you know, in a way she's not trying to hide her friendship with her, but in a way she is, and they have to deal with all of that. But Gina becomes really the first friend that Gracie makes after the suicide of her mother. She had a friend in Germany during that period when they were living there. But Gina becomes the first friend whom she sees on a, you know, regular basis, and to whom she begins to talk in some real way, and through whom, I mean, it's Gina and it's a young man who had been Janny's babysitter and the English teacher, who all begin to say to Gracie, hey, you really are a writer. You might be able to find yourself as a writer.
So talking about writing, would you like to read a passage from the book?
I would love to. I will read the prologue of the book, because to me it really holds a lot of the themes of the book. And also, it is the only thing that remains from the original piece I wrote 20 years ago. So here's the prologue. Someone told me the story of a chimpanzee named Bibi. Bibi was involved in a study at some university, in the course of which she was taught sign language. She was a quick learner and unusually creative. After a while, she was making up original signs to convey to the researchers increasing levels of emotional and intellectual complexity. Bibi's desire to share what she experienced possessed her completely. The researchers learned more from Bibi about the inner life of chimpanzees than they ever expected to. After some years, the grant that funded the study was exhausted, and Bibi and the other chimps were dispersed to different facilities. Bibi found herself confined to a cage, unable to relate to humans and other chimpanzees as she had been free to do in the laboratory she had come from. No one signed to her. With no possibility of communicating, Bibi languished. Occasionally, her caretakers observed her moving her fingers in what looked like some inner monologue. But after a while, her passion to connect with others, her passion to articulate her thoughts, diminished, meeting no response. Then one day, after Bibi had been in that place for 13 years, a man who had been on the original research team happened to visit. Bibi recognized him at once. He was on his way down the corridor to a meeting, and she went into a frenzy, jumping up and down in her cage, rattling the bars with all her might, desperately signing over and over, "Me, Bibi, me, Bibi, me, Bibi."
Yeah, that was so powerful when I read that. I mean, my heart was just wrenched. Is that based on a true story?
You know, it's based on a story which I believe is true. I heard it at a workshop. I have done a number of workshops with my beloved friend and co-translator of Rilke, Joanna Macy, who's 93 now and still working. And she did a workshop about 22 years ago. You know, all her workshops are about coming in touch with our pain for the world, basically, and with the ecological disaster that we're living in and how we can work to change that. And she always asks people to tell stories that seem relevant to what we're working with. And so a young man at that workshop about 22 years ago told that story. I changed Bibi's name for confidentiality's sake. The chimpanzee he spoke about had a different name. And that story really moved me. I mean, as it has you, because it seemed like, you know, we are all Bibi. We all just want to be seen and known. We all just want to be recognized. And when we are not, when we can't, when we find ourselves in a situation or in an environment where that recognition is not possible and where our own expression of ourselves can't be received, I think it's one of the most excruciating experiences human beings have, and animals.
So true. Well, it has been just such a privilege to talk with you, Anita Barrows, about your beautiful novel, The Language of Birds. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Francesca. I have so enjoyed this. It's been wonderful to talk with you about this.
Next up on Writer's Voice, Reviving Ophelia author Mary Pfeiffer's new memoir. Stay tuned after the break. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Mary Pfeiffer has been exploring what sustains us as individuals, members of families, and of society for well over 20 years. From her classic, Reviving Ophelia, to the last book we spoke with her about, Women Rowing North, Pfeiffer puts us in touch with ourselves, our challenges, and our resilience. Her latest book is a memoir, A Life in Light, where she draws on these challenges and strengths as they applied in her own life. Drawing from her own experiences and expertise as a psychologist specializing in women, trauma, and the effect of our culture on mental health, Mary Pfeiffer looks inward to what shaped her as a woman, one who's experienced darkness throughout her life, but was always drawn to the light. Well, Mary Pfeiffer, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's really good to be with you again, Francesca.
And this book is deceptively simple, A Life in Light, Meditations on Impermanence. It's a memoir and a beautiful memoir. And I just want to start right out with the major theme there. What does light mean for you?
First of all, I have been extremely aware of light since I was a very young child. My first memory, before I had words, is actually of light, encoded in light. And that was a time someone lay me on a blanket in my grandmother's front yard. I don't know how old I was, but I think I was very young. It was before I had speech. And I was looking up at light in trees and watching the sunlight and shadow in these dancing leaves overhead. And I remember that. I remember how beautiful the sparkle was of the light coming through those leaves. But I've always been someone who wanted to be outside, wanted to be in the sun. If I walk into a room and there's a shade drawn, I can't get to that shade fast enough to pull it up. I've never been able to work in a basement or a room without an office. So there's light in the literal sense that virtually every major moment of my life, the memory is light filled. But there's also light in the metaphorical sense in that I came out of a fairly rough early childhood. And I figured out when I was quite young that to be happy, I needed to be looking in the direction of the positive. I needed to figure out ways to bring myself out of the darkness. So that metaphor of light as resilience, of light as seeking transcendent experiences, is a very important part of this book.
Yes, it is. And yet you don't shy away from the dark either. One thinks of patterns that you looked up to when you were just an infant there. There were patterns of light and dark in a way. And that's very much the theme of your book. Tell us first about some of the hardness of that early life of yours.
Well, first of all, I loved my parents, and I've never claimed my life was much harder than anyone else's. It's very hard to know who wins in a suffering contest. And I think most of us have times in our lives that are very difficult. But when I was a child, young child, my father signed up to fight in the army during the Korean conflict. And my mother started medical school when I was a year old. And my father returned a couple times. Once my mother became pregnant with another brother after he left. And so it was me and two little brothers living in a very small house in Aurora, which was then a little town outside of Denver, while my mom went to medical school. And I experienced a lot of missing my mother, who was gone all day and very tired when she came home, missing my dad, who I had really been fond of. And the three children, we grew up without much parenting. And then when I was six, my dad came home from Korea. He and my mother were not getting along at all. They really developed along very separate ways during their time apart. And so he took me and one of my brothers and moved us to the Ozarks to live in a trailer behind his sister's house. So I had a year without my younger brother, John, and I had a year without my mother. And that year was a very dark year for me. Our dad was gone a lot. He was a very traumatized man who was drinking and playing cards and running around. And Jake and I spent a lot of time in a dark trailer. So that was one of the darkest years of my life. I also had trouble later when I was at college. My dad had had a series of crippling strokes. I was out in San Francisco. I'd come from a conservative, small town, Methodist family, and I found myself in a totally different world, which I loved in many ways and was just magical and wonderful and stimulating. But I also felt a great darkness in my heart because I was aware that while I was at Berkeley going to school and enjoying all the excitement and culture of the Bay Area, my mother was at home with the stroke victim husband and two children, my sister and my brother, teenagers without parents. And I felt very far from where I should be at the same time and a little bit lost as to who I was. So that was one time I couldn't find light. And I actually wrote about that because I think all of us try our best to turn toward the sun, to find ways to make ourselves happy and find beauty when we're having a hard time. But we don't always succeed. And I wanted to have at least one, I think there's maybe three chapters in the book, where my search for light, given a particular experience, isn't successful.
Yeah, and you blamed yourself for your father's stroke, and then your boyfriend at the time became mentally ill. Why did you blame yourself for the unhappiness of others or the misfortune of others?
Well, that's a very complicated question. And if you were a therapist, we could talk about that for 3 hours. I think part of it is children that grow up without parents, one of the ways they find safety and comfort is in believing they have a lot of control and that their behavior really matters. And that belief can be extremely helpful in terms of giving a child a sense of control. But also when things go wrong, like my father's terrible stroke, I think it can lead to the illusion that somehow, in my case, if I had acted differently, my father might not have had that stroke. And I still believe I caused my father's stroke because he was a very conservative man who expected me to be a good student on her way to medical school, who didn't drink or smoke and certainly didn't become involved with a partner in a sexual way. And just before I was home for Thanksgiving, my boyfriend was with me. And I think my father sensed by the way we interacted that we'd had an intimate relationship, and he had a stroke the next day. And I think those are connected. I don't feel I should have been a different person. I don't feel I should have owed it to my father to never have a sexual relationship or drink or smoke, some of the things I was doing at that time. But I feel there was a connection between the two events. And Francesca, what I tried to do in this book was share as honestly as I could the stories of how I built the person I am today. And I used the metaphor Koma Rebbe, dappled light in the treetops, because I really wanted to show readers that my life, like their lives, are filled with light and shadow, and that there's a way to find the light with effort, with choice, in every situation, in almost every situation. So I hope I did that with this book.
I think you did. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with author and former psychologist Mary Pfeiffer about her new memoir, A Life in Light. You know, I really related to this book, A Life in Light, Meditations on Impermanence, because I remember that when I was 40, I went through one of those real existential midlife crises in which, you know, I just hadn't achieved the things that I thought I should have achieved at that age. And I was able to function, but barely, and it went on for 9 months. I've always thought that was quite symbolic that it went on for nine
right.
months. And one day during the summer vacation, I had taken my son for a journey out west, and we went to Big Sur, California, which is my favorite place and has one of the most amazing lights in the world, I think. And I was just on a hillside there with my son, who was 12 at the time. It was a beautiful day. The light was shining, and I looked around and I realized, like you had realized at a much earlier age, that happiness is a choice, that I could choose to stay in the dark. And the implication of that was suicide, really, which was not a choice because I was a single parent and I'm responsible for a child, or I could choose to accept. I could choose what is. So I think that is also acceptance is very much what you write about in this book. And yet acceptance is not an easy concept, neither in Buddhism nor in, you know, life in general. So talk a little bit about what does it mean to accept, to make a choice for the positive, even when life seems pretty bleak.
Well, first of all, I congratulate you on having that experience and figuring out what you needed to figure out to move more into the light. And secondly, I love the light in Big Sur too. And Big Sur is one of my happy places. I love Big Sur. It's just beautiful beyond belief. Well, in terms of your question, as you know, having read the book, I'm a Buddhist. And one of the great teachings of Buddhism is accepting reality. Coming to terms with the fact that life changes constantly, that the only thing we know for sure is the next second will be different than the second we're in. And one of the great lessons of COVID, I think, is accepting the fact that our lives do not stay the same as we might want them to, and accepting the fact that the future is much more unpredictable than we were led to believe. So when I wrote this book, I was actually in the COVID era, and it was extraordinarily difficult for me to accept. I'm a very social person. I love being around people. I'm a lively person, generally have a lot going on in terms of walks with friends and lunches out. And my husband's a musician in about 5 bands, so there's always someplace I can go and dance or be out at a winery listening to music or something. And anyway, during this period, I was home alone, as was everyone. My husband and I were home alone. And my daughter lives in Canada. The border closed, so we knew we wouldn't see our grandchildren. My other son, who lives in a small town, was living in a very conservative area where a lot of COVID was around, so we didn't see that family either. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is I felt like I needed to have a project in the morning when I woke up to give me a sense of hope and purpose. And I wanted that project that accurately reflected my own struggles with the pandemic, but also as I managed to work my way through the darkness in my heart that it caused, I hoped it might be of use to readers. So that was very much the whole idea of accepting the reality of the pandemic, accepting the reality I couldn't see my children, my friends, no music, the bands all shut down, etc. That was very much a major learning task during COVID. Then there's another kind of acceptance that I write about in the book some, and that is accepting aging. I'm 74 this year, and I realized as I wrote this book that all my life, in part because of my early childhood, I've been a heat-seeking mammal. I have really wanted to be loved, to love people, to have a lot of people around me. I like parties. I like potlucks. I like dancing at the Zoo Bar with my friends. I really like large and small group behavior and close friends. And I did have family around me. I had 5 lovely grandchildren around me for a long time. But some of the grandchildren have grown up. Others have moved to Canada. And I'm realizing that the great task of the last couple decades of my life will be learning to detach. Because the people that gave me so much joy in the early years of my life are to a certain extent leaving. Either they're leaving because they're growing up and growing away from us, or they're leaving because they're dying. And I'm going to a lot of funerals these days of people I've known 50 years. So I've really worked on learning to let go of attachments and instead look for some of the light and love I was able to find in other people. I've learned to look for that in my own heart. And I write about that change from being a very externally oriented person in terms of looking for the light, to becoming more, having more inner strength within myself to find that light. So that's what I'm working on accepting. I don't think, unless we're enlightened, we ever reach the point when we totally accept loss and change. But it's one of the great lessons. Accepting impermanence is one of the great lessons of life. And it's a spiritual path as well as a psychological path.
I know that, I mean, I also consider myself a Buddhist in perspective and philosophy, although I have struggled a lot since the pandemic started with meditating. And it's not just the pandemic. In fact, I was talking about this the other day with a Zen priest who's in the Sangha that I used to attend. And she said, well, why aren't you meditating? And I said, I think that the grief that I feel every day at the loss of the natural world, at the loss of our rights, at the loss of justice, of the terrible injustice in the world, and, you know, how things are just spinning out of control, I'm afraid to touch that grief in my meditation. And that's where the acceptance becomes difficult. It's hard to accept injustice.
Well, you and I are kindred spirits in so many ways. And what you're saying is, of course, not only yours and my existential problem, but it's everyone's problem right now. For example, one thing I have talked about in my Sangha is this sense of having a double consciousness. And by now, I can make, for the most part, the choices, and I have the skills to build a good day for myself. You know, I can be outside some, I can have some meaningful work, I can be with a friend or talk to a friend on the phone and have some fun with my husband and, you know, cook a good meal and read a good book, and I can build a good day. And most of my friends can too. And when we get together, we tend to talk about books and movies and vacations and new restaurants opening in my town and so on and so on. But beyond that very circumscribed life of building a good day, seeing our friends, having a good time at an outdoor concert, say, is this darkness. And it feels like all these clouds are around us. And we've got a little patch of blue above us, but there's so much darkness around us. And, you know, I don't know how to deal with that darkness. The way people are dealing with it, I know how we are dealing with it, which is we tend to do our best to block it out. And then at 3 a.m, it comes back in and we remember it. I don't usually meditate on that darkness. I work very hard to stay in the present moment. And the only other feeling I have about all that darkness is the antidote to despair is action. So I'm doing, and I think many of us are doing what we can locally. I'm leader of an environmental group. And I also, this winter, my husband and I and two other couples sponsored a big Afghan family that came into our community. So for me, it's very comforting in the face of all the darkness to have one or two or three projects that make me feel like, given the givens, given my own helplessness to transform the world as I wish I could, at least I'm helping one family, or I'm doing some things locally, hopefully to improve our environment. And that's all I know. That's all I know, Francesca. I feel for you. I feel for me. I feel for all of us right now, as we know with the world we have to live in.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with author and former psychologist Mary Pfeiffer about her new memoir, A Life in Light. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I too am very active, but I also really hear what you're saying about building a good day. I think that's some of the light seeking that we all do have a choice to do. I remember when I was much younger reading, what was his name? He was a philosopher who came out of the concentration camps.
Frankl, Viktor Frankl.
Yes, Viktor Frankl. And, you know, how he also talked about that choice that we all, each of us, even in the most difficult of circumstances, have the choice that we can make to be the best that we can be.
And it's not the happiness of feeding grandchildren raspberries on a summer afternoon, but there's a relief and a comfort in helping other people. I've always known that. When I was a child, I found comfort in helping animals. There's a chapter in A Life in Light where I talk about going out and finding little animals to rescue after a rainstorm and feeding baby mice or baby squirrels, whatever it was, birds, a lot of little birds, just because it made me feel good. And for a long time, when I've gotten very blue and had a struggle to have a good day, one of my most common skills, I'll call it a skill because it works for me as a skill, is to think of somebody who'd like to hear my voice and just call them up and talk to them. A lot of times it's an older person, someone who's pretty isolated. But as I talk to that person, I start feeling happier. I feel like, well, at least I'm doing one good thing today. And that always will cheer me up a little bit.
Yeah, and you say that you hear your mother's voice every night. Now, I should say that you also write in the book that neither of your parents had the gift of empathy, and you definitely have the gift of empathy, plus you became a clinical psychologist, a therapist. But you say you hear your mother's voice every night. What does she say to you?
Well, you know, my mother's voice is very in my head, and she was autistic. I'm pretty convinced of that now, knowing what I know. But she was autistic before there was a definition of autistic. And if I view her as autistic, a lot of her behavior in terms of shipping us children around and not being present and so on makes more sense, because that kind of core ability to attach and empathize wasn't with her. On the other hand, she was a deeply moral person. She never refused medical care to anyone, ever. And when she'd leave the house, she'd always say to us children, be kind to each other when I'm gone. And when I was growing up, she was very inclined to say things like, your job is to help somebody, or did you do a good deed today? And she herself built a life out of doing good deeds. She did nothing but help people with her life. And she modeled that. So a lot of the messages I get from my mother have to do with trying to be a good person, to be kind, to work, to find out where I'm needed and to work. She had absolutely no patience with people who sat around. And she'd be horrified to know I'm a Buddhist, because one time she said to me, I asked her if she knew anything about Buddhism when I was a girl. And she said, I have no use for people who sit around contemplating their navel. And that was her opinion of Buddhism. And she also had no use for patients who complained. She called them nutjobs and weaklings. So I think for her, it was kind of shocking I became a therapist, because really she had very little respect for people who had psychological issues. Her idea was, if you have a psychological issue, go to work. And if you start being busy and taking care of other people, you won't have a psychological issue. So she was pretty tough that way. But that's not the part of her messaging I absorbed. I absorbed the part of her messaging that had to do with trying to be a good person and kind. And I'm very grateful for it.
Now, Reviving Ophelia is possibly your most famous book. And I've been thinking about it quite a bit during this pandemic, because adolescent girls have been, I think, among those who have suffered the most in some ways, have had the most struggles, you know, in terms of psychologically with the COVID pandemic. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about adolescent girls and talk about the struggles that you see them going through and how they can move out of that.
You know, I'm not sure you're aware of this, Francesca, but my daughter and I just brought out, a couple years ago, the 25th edition of Reviving Ophelia. And we actually rewrote it. In fact, knowing what I know now, I think I would have just written a different book, because going in and taking out what was no longer relevant in reviving and interviewing new girls and doing focus groups and so on with so much work, I think we would have been better off to just write a new book. But because we did do this massive update of Reviving Ophelia, I actually am fairly up to date on what's going on with teenage girls. And on one hand, on the positive hand, I think they're a more tolerant group and more inclined, for example, to have friends of all races, to be very relaxed around the whole idea of bisexuality, transgender, and so on. On the other hand, one of the things that, well, I'll tell you two things that really hit me from doing this research is girls don't interact very much with other people. They spend a lot of their time in their bedrooms with Netflix on or music, texting. And when I was a girl, for example, every Saturday night, we'd have a slumber party or we'd go as a big group to a movie, or there was just a lot of girls grouping together and talking until 3 a.m. and so on. And that is almost gone. There's much less interaction between girls actually being together. And that's pre-pandemic. That's more about the digital world and the fact that there are many fewer places for girls to just get together and hang out and feel safe and good. Another thing that really struck me about this generation of girls is they're given much less responsibility than girls used to be given. For example, when I wrote Reviving Ophelia 25 plus years ago, many girls worked outside the home. It was pretty common. And as of late, most girls do not work outside of the home. And they don't actually do much housework in their own homes as a general rule. Of course, there's exceptions. For example, many girls don't get driver's licenses. As a result, they seem much younger than girls used to seem. At the same time, in terms of things like sexual behavior and cynicism and awareness of politics, they seem much older. So it's a very interesting. I didn't know if I could reinterest myself and reacquaint myself with the world of adolescent girls, but it was really interesting to me and just fascinating to interview girls, talk to them about how they spent their time. One thing, for example, that surprised me, and this is like pre-Uvalde and some time ago, but we got on the topic of how girls feel at school, and they are terrified. I mean, girls really talked about how frightened they were of being shot in their schools. And it just broke my heart because you hear adults talk about that, journalists, or you hear politicians talk about that, or gun control advocates, whatever. But to hear children talk about it is really a very moving experience.
And tragic.
Yeah, absolutely.
So finally, in A Life in Light, Meditations on Impermanence, Mary Pfeiffer, you say that writing has brought light into your life. And I wanted to ask you what you meant by that.
Well, I love being a writer. And by now, I've been a writer longer than I was a therapist. I've always called myself a therapist who wrote, but I was a therapist, I think, for maybe 24 years. And I've been a writer now since 1994, which is 28 years. So I've been a writer longer than a therapist. And I loved being a therapist, but writing it's something I always wanted to do and was discouraged by my parents who came out of the Depression. Both of them said, you can't make a living as a writer. And so I pushed that goal away until I was in my 40s. And then I decided, I don't care if I'm good at it. I don't need to make money at it. I just want to write. I've wanted to write since I was a little girl, and I started writing. And there's so many things about writing. It's an extraordinarily interesting way to live twice, once in real time and another in processed, reflected, and arranged time. And so that is a good thing. Psychologically, it's a beautiful way to understand oneself. Whenever I start a book, I think I know what I'm going to be doing. I never end up doing it. I always end up going in a direction that's surprising to me and fresh. And so as I write, I learn. For example, with A Light in Light, I had no idea when I started A Light in Life that I would end up with the discovery that I needed to find light in my own heart. That was in no way part of the original plan with that book. But I discovered it as a writer writing the book, and I discovered it as a person. And I'm not sure if I hadn't written the book that I would have been able to come to that understanding and acceptance.
Well, it's a beautiful book and an inspiring one as well. It was a pleasure to read and a pleasure to talk with you, Mary Pfeiffer, about A Life in Light.
Thank you so much.
Mary Pfeiffer is the author of 11 books. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our conversation about a previous one, Women Rowing North. And we have just enough time left for a poem by Anita Barros, who was our first guest on today's show. This is Lessons from Darkness, and it's headed by a quote from Martin Luther. "I'm afraid of the darkness and the hole in it, and I see it sometime of every day." Here's the poem. Everything you love will perish. Try saying this to yourself at breakfast, watching the amber-colored tea swirl in the teapot. Try it on the tree, the clouds, the dog asleep under the table, the sparrow taking a bath in the neighbor's gutter. A magician's act, presto! On a morning you feel open enough to embrace it, imagine it gone. Then pack the child's lunch. Smooth the thick peanut butter, the jeweled raspberry preserves over the bread. Tell yourself the world must go on forever. This is why you feed her, imagining the day orderly, unfolding, imagining what you teach her is true, is something she will use. This is why, later, you will go out into the garden, among the calendula, rosemary, hibiscus. Run your finger along the trunk of hawthorn as though it were the body of a lover, thinking of the child on the steps of the schoolyard eating her sandwich, thinking nothing, transparent air where her hands are. That was Lessons from Darkness by Anita Barros. Get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @WritersVoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.